I hungry. This looks really good, doesn't it?
Yeah, sure does.
Avengers dinner. Here we go.
Yes, I love you. I mean, now we can eat like the Avengers.
Yeah.
I'm going to have a nice plate of shawarma.
No, man. That's not what the Avengers eat.
Yes, they did.
Nope.
At the end, they all go out and eat shawarma.
Maybe that's what you think, but that's not what I prepared for you today. Are you ready for this?
I don't know. What is it?
It's the skulls and skins of those we've vanquished.
I don't think I want to eat that.
Don't be a chicken. It'll be delicious.
Hi, this is Paul Dini.
And this is Misty Lee, and we actually are having shawarma.
Yes, we are. We are dining superhero style,
yeah.
In the style of the Avengers. If you've seen the movie, if you've stuck it through the end scene at the credits, it got such a great laugh when we saw it that we had to go out and get some and have it for this week. So we went to Zankow Chicken, got some of their great chicken tarna and some of their beef shawarma, and are enjoying it.
And we are not dining alone. We have with us, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. B.R. Morrison.
Yeah.
And Ezra and Emily.
Ezra and Emily.
Yeah.
Sorry, I can't talk. Eating shawarma.
Eating shawarma. I mean, if you haven't seen The Avengers and we blew the ending for you, my God, why are you listening to this?
Well, podcast? Iron Man dies, so he's not there.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah, that's right.
So, I mean...
And they do eat him at the end, so Rashi is right. They do consume the blood and body of their
Ewoks should have.
Mm-hmm. The Ewoks should have. Yeah, I always felt like they should have. They, like, you know, oh, Wicket got killed. Let's haul his body over and let's roast him.
They had skulls and, you know, bones hanging everywhere all along their camp, so
well,
why not?
The Ewoks are pretty warped, actually. I mean, I had numerous conversations with George Lucas about Ewok culture and what they did and what they didn't do, and a lot of it was very enlightening and thought out, and what he didn't tell me, I just sort of made up. So I added some stuff he'd probably be horrified about if you thought to ask.
Well, you speak Ewokies, don't you? Don't answer an Ewok, please. I will divorce you.
Chuck.
Damn it.
No, call the lawyer.
Snuck
I
in.
Said yes in Ewokies. Chuck. Yum yum.
God.
Eat your wawa.
Eat your wawa.
Eat your wawa.
Eat your wawa.
I'm
going to
eat my shawarma.
Yeah, eat your shawarma.
Goodbye, lerdos. That means.
You know what? Enough.
Hello, idiots.
Yes, all right.
Okay, all right.
So, Bill. About the Boy Scouts.
Yes. Oh, wow.
That was a beautiful segue.
Yes. It was very, very
wow,
seamless.
Wow, I got whiplash.
Oh, wait. Can I mention one more geek thing before we get in the thick of it?
No.
Yes, I must mention this.
Why did you ask?
Well.
Because he wants to tease me.
Yes. I have to throw out a quick plug to our good pal Kevin Smith, who this last week, probably 2 weeks ago now, has debuted a new feature over on his Smodcast called Fat Man on Batman.
Oh.
Batman on Batman is Kevin's profile on the ongoing Batman legend, and he is talking to people who have contributed in some ways to the Batman mythos, and which he himself has contributed quite a few things. But the first guest was myself. And I don't know when he's going to do another one, but it was...
Cheating on us with another podcast.
I know. It's horrific.
Infidelicast.
Yeah, I know. I had a lot of fun doing it and came off pretty well. And if you go over to his Sir site, you should be able to find it in the archives.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big shout out for that. The
podcast we did was actually prominently featured over on Sir the other day. They had a big one in the middle.
Wow. Oh, really? Oh, that's cool. Mm-hmm. That's great. I enjoy doing those. Those are a lot of fun. We have to get Kevin and Jennifer over here sometime.
No, we should.
Yeah,
they've never been over here to the house.
No, they haven't.
Mm-mm.
At one point, Harley wanted
Harley's
to...
been here.
Harley wanted to come over and take riding lessons. They were talking about, we bought a horse. Can we board it at your house? It's like...
What the hell?
Maybe.
Do they say if or they did buy one?
If we buy a horse.
Oh, I thought they had purchased one and they were requesting... Like,
no,
hey,
but they were thinking
it
about it. They were thinking about riding lessons at one point. So,
Much as I love them, they cannot keep their horse here.
We have three savage animals who cannot stand each other. So We have to keep it to the canines and canine adjacent creatures.
So, Bill, about the Boy Scouts.
Yes, dear.
You want to tell them? You do some really you. First of all, how long were you in Boy Scouts, and how high did you get?
That's a loaded question. Given that I was in the Boy Scouts in the early 70s. No, I actually...
You don't have to give us yours. Because it goes by rank, right?
Yes. I made the rank of Eagle Scout.
Wow.
Which is a big deal, because that's a huge commitment. Like, you, yeah. how long yeah. do you have to be in Scouts? Like, what are the criteria for achieving
well,
that?
Well, it doesn't go by years. I mean, you can make Eagle fairly quickly if you're really ambitious.
Okay.
So you just kind of go through the ranks. You start with...
Weeblow?
No, you start with Tenderfoot.
Okay.
And then you go to...
Brownie.
First class.
Brownie. Campfire girl.
Well, yeah. Hopefully you get to, you know, cross the lake and meet some brownies.
Yeah.
Girl Scouts, I would hope, because brownies are the little ones.
During your tenure in Boy
Scouts.
Bill's
like, I like the daisies.
Bluebirds.
Yeah, Bluebirds was...
Bluebirds was...
Bluebirds
part
and
of
Campfire
Girls.
Girls.
Yeah. Campfire Girls, that's right.
Different company.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
I think that was a Catholic...
Ring around
was
the campfire.
Lutheran. Yeah.
Campfire
Lutheran.
Girl.
Wasn't that?
What?
Maybe Lutheran, yeah.
I don't know.
I think Jane, my sister, was a Bluebird.
Okay.
She wore the uniform around. I remember that.
So poor Bill is trying to tell us what he did. He was a Tenderfoot first.
Yeah, Tenderfoot, first class, second class, Star, Life, and then Eagle.
Wow.
Wow.
And, you know, it's a matter of accumulating merit badges, and some of them are, or at least I think they were when I was a scout, were required. And then there, you know, there are a certain number of just sort of elective merit badges that you can kind of take whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
I remember this one time we were at summer camp,
mm-hmm.
and this was at DBRA Scout Ranch in Metamora, Michigan.
Metamora.
Yeah.
I did a show there once.
Did you?
I don't know why.
Is it a rustic place? Is it out in the woods?
Yeah, way mm-hmm. out in the woods.
Yeah, I don't remember what I was doing there.
You know, real serial killer kind of locale.
Get your merit badge and dismemberment.
You know, you think of the woods, and I think of, you know, like waterfalls and bears and, Mm-mm. you know, foxes and blackberries and everything. You know, everybody else, you know, serial killers and
you don't watch
inbreds.
Enough movies, dude. Okay, so you remember that Metamora.
So, yeah, so there was one of the big things about summer camp was you would try to get as many merit badges as you could
mm-hmm.
during the week, because they would have counselors there to, you know, sort of run you through different badges that you wanted to get. So I decided to get leatherworking merit badge.
Wow.
So there were a couple of projects I had to do, and did those during the week. And then at the very end of the week, you had to meet with your merit badge counselor and take a test. There was like a sort of like an oral test.
Wow.
And it was all stuff that was in the handbook, you know, the merit badge guide, which, you know, I kind of glanced at. So I was somewhat prepared. But this guy asked the question, name three types of leather.
And I didn't know there's more than one.
Well, glory be, yes there are.
Wow.
So I sat there and I said, okay, well, there's cowhide. And the guy said, yeah, that's right. And I said, there's rawhide.
Oh.
And he said, well, and there were actually two guys, and they were like, yeah, I guess so. You know, that's kind of, you know, it's sort of, it's the same thing,
it's
but
been processed,
okay.
Yeah.
It's a good TV show.
And then I was stumped for a third one. And I just spit out formaldehyde.
Oh my God.
And these guys just started laughing. And they said, you know, that was so funny, we're going to give it to you.
That's hysterical.
What
kinds of
the
leather,
other
according
like,
to Bill Morrison?
Like
pig skin?
Yeah, pig skin.
Sheepskin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sheepskin. Yeah.
Basically, you know, just kind of name off the different animals
deer skin. Other
skin
types of
skin,
leather,
yeah.
according to Bill Morrison, Jekyll and Hyde,
mm-hmm.
and hide and seek.
Yeah, I could have kept going.
Yes.
Wow. That's really cute.
But yeah, I made my eagle. I attained the rank of eagle. And they say once you're an Eagle Scout, you're always an Eagle Scout. You can leave the Boy Scouts, but no matter what, you're always still an Eagle Scout.
Mm-hmm.
So
they may call upon you for some errand at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're in the big Scout Mafia.
Yeah. Yeah.
Luckily, I was, you know, too old to have to go overseas and fight.
Oh, but, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Were you ever, you know, did your scout training, did you ever think about joining the military, some branch of the armed services?
Not even once.
No.
And the funny thing is, once I got out of Boy Scouts, I know I've gone camping a few times, but it's like that wasn't even kind of ingrained in me from scouting. I've always been sort of an urban suburban kind of a person, and I like the outdoors, but kind of in small doses.
Modern day amenities, boy.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed the scouting experience, and I believe in it. I think it's a great thing for kids. I don't have any kids myself, so you know, if I had a son, it's probably something I would have gotten back into. But I did sort of get back into scouting.
This is why I brought it up. You know where I was going with it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, because this is really cool.
Well, a couple of years ago, actually going back probably 10 years, I met a guy named Frank Mallon, who was a friend of my father's. And Frank was a professional scouter in the Detroit area where I grew up.
And by scouter, you mean boy scouter, not like sports scouter.
Yeah.
Okay.
He worked for the scout organization. So he was paid by them. And, you know, there are certain people in the organization who are paid professionals, and then there's a lot of volunteers. So my dad was a volunteer, and even after I left scouting, he stayed with it, and he remained the scoutmaster of our troop, and then got into scoutmaster training, and he was a district commissioner for a while.
Wow.
So right up till the day he died, he was involved in scouting. So after, I think it was after, it was after I had started drawing The Simpsons, my dad asked me if I would come home and do this. They had like this cub day camp, like a week-long day camp for cubs, and they would get the Boy Scouts to work as the counselors to, you know, just kind of wrangle the kids and teach classes and run games and that kind of thing. So my dad asked me if I would, you know, could come up with stuff to reward the boys with. So I worked at the time in at Fox Merchandising, and I was doing all the merchandise art for The Simpsons. And we would get in on a daily basis samples of all the merchandise.
Awesome.
And so this was back when, I mean, there was just a ton of Simpsons merchandise coming out. And they would, the executives there would have to distribute the merchandise to, you know, Matt Groening and James Brooks and Sam Simon and some of the other writers and executives. And then what was that, whatever was left over, the employees there at Fox Licensing would get to go through and kind of pick out what we wanted. So every so often we would get like a trip to the storage closet.
Nice.
Oh yeah.
And I just amassed a ton of stuff. Some of it that I, you know, worked on, I wanted to keep sort of for my personal archive, but a lot of stuff that I just gave away. And so I would save it for my nieces and nephews for Christmas or whatever.
I do the same with the Batman stuff. I have a vault of it. It's the storage unit.
Yeah, it comes in handy.
Yeah.
Last minute Christmas giving.
Oh, absolutely.
So I sent a bunch of this stuff to my dad, and he asked if I could, you know, maybe be in town during the camp because he wanted me to come and do a signing. So I brought a bunch of comics and did a big signing, and I think that was where I met Frank. And the weird thing was, he knew that I drew The Simpsons, but that's all he knew about me as far as my ability or my experience as an artist was that I drew these little weird-looking cartoon characters with bulgy eyes and no chins.
But it also has to be said that anybody who knows that you're working on a network cartoon show knows that you have a pretty high level of excellence to have arrived at that point. You know, I mean, really. So anyway.
Yeah.
He didn't know a ton about you. He didn't know about your fine art background, essentially,
right,
is what you're saying.
So, yeah, he didn't know that I was a painter and illustrator.
Right, and a damn good one, too.
Oh, shucks.
He's got a show coming up. I'll have him tell you guys about it before he's done.
Well, Frank asked me if... He kind of pitched this idea to me that he had this vision to do a mural for the 100th anniversary of scouting, for the centennial, which was coming up... At that point, it was coming up in, like, 10 years. And... or even more. It might have even been like 15 years. So he's talking this idea to me, and I'm kind of, you know, paying it lip service by just saying, oh, that's a great idea, and yeah, I'd love to be involved in that. And I, in the back of my mind, I'm just thinking, you know, this is never going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
This just sounds like just a huge undertaking. Basically, what he wanted to do is he wanted this piece of artwork created that depicted the history of scouting in one image. And then he wanted to have prints made, which he would distribute in person using, you know, using like a group of volunteers. He was going to get an RV unit, like a Winnebago,
mm-hmm.
and have teams of people deliver these prints to every scout council in the United States.
Wow.
Over the course of a year. And they would do about two stops per day. They would hit about two councils per day, have a ceremony to present this print, and then go on to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, my father passed away, and I kind of thought that would be the end of it, but he stayed in touch. And it got down
Frank did. Okay.
Yeah. Not my dad.
I was like, because if your father passed away and stayed in touch, then you and I need to have a serious talk about,
yes.
about some things at the Magic Castle that I'm doing over there. A
little seance.
Yeah, I would give it to him.
I would love to talk to my dad again. So, yeah, we should talk about that. Anyway, you know,
so
he kept after me about this, and I started to realize he was really serious. So I was coming home to Michigan for Christmas or something, and Frank said, we're having this meeting of all the volunteers, and I'd like you to come. And, you know, it's a few years away now, but, you know, it's getting close, and I'd like to talk about your artwork that you're doing. And I said, okay. So at that point, I had done nothing because I really didn't think this was going to happen.
Right.
But I was so impressed with how organized he was. And I mean, he was serious. He had all his ducks in a row. They were getting an RV unit donated.
Donated.
Wow. Also, a chase car.
Okay.
Like if they had any problems, you know, with breakdowns mm-hmm. on the road, they would have a vehicle. They got Penske Motors to donate all the maintenance and repairs on the vehicles, on both vehicles.
Wow.
So all across the country, they could stop at any Penske and get free service.
That's great.
They had like the whole route. They had a map of the United States with all these pins in it, you know, where all the councils were, and you know, lines running from pin to pin showing the exact route that the vehicle would take. And so what they ended up doing was they would have a team of people. They had an opening ceremony. This is what ended up actually happening. They had an opening ceremony. Then they sent the first team off on their way. And then after a week, you know, they went to as many councils as were on the schedule. Then another team flew into the city where they ended up
mm-hmm.
and took over the RV. And then the first team flew back to Detroit. And they did that for a whole year.
Wow.
From February to February, February of 2009 to February of 2010. And 2010 was the centennial.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, backing up, I realized they were serious and I'd better get my butt in gear and start working on this piece of artwork.
Mm-hmm.
So they handed me, they'd handed me these two binders full of images, like the whole history of scouting. One was 1910 to 1960, and the other was 1961 up to the present day.
And what a cool thing to be able to see. I mean, how many Boy Scouts have actually had their hands on such a thing?
Yeah, it's an amazing archive of stuff.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And they were like, here you are.
And I had
to
go
biting your fingernails.
It was, it was really intimidating because I had to pour through these two binders. I mean, they were thick, like 3 inches thick, each of them, and figure out like what were the important moments in scouting that had to go into this painting, and which, you know, what elements could be cut. And I didn't really feel like I was equipped to do that because I knew my experience in scouting and I knew a little bit about the history, but I really didn't know, you know, to guys who live scouting, live and breathe it, what are the important, who are the important figures, and what are the important moments in scouting?
So how did you decide?
Well, I did the best I could, and I created a layout.
Okay.
And I remember doing a sketch, and then I did like a key, because it was a rough sketch, and I figured all the likenesses weren't perfect, so the people who were reviewing the image wouldn't necessarily know who the people were. So I created one of those keys that was like an outline drawing, and it had numbers,
mm-hmm. uh-huh.
and then a legend. So it said, you know, this is Baden Powell. This is, you know, all the different people who were like
who
the original.
Who is Mr. Powell?
Baden Powell was the founder of scouting.
Okay.
In Great Britain.
Okay. Is that where it started?
That's where it started.
Did Teddy Roosevelt start the scouts? Was he involved in it in some way?
No, he wasn't.
He wasn't.
Involved.
Oh, okay.
No, he may have been a supporter of it, but he wasn't involved in the founding of it. But there was a guy who went over to England. And I'm blanking on his name right now, but he's in the print, and he was lost in a fog. He was wandering around London trying to get to an appointment. And he was lost in the fog, and he came upon this Boy Scout. And he'd never seen a Boy Scout. It looked like a kid in a soldier's uniform with mm-hmm. short pants.
Uh-huh.
And the kid said, you know, can I help you find your way? And he said, well, I'm looking for this address. And the scout helped him to get to where he was going. And so he said, you know, what are you? You know, what's this uniform and what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm a Boy Scout. And so he had to find out, you know, what is this all about? This is really cool.
Mm-hmm.
So he did. And, you know, I think he met with Baden Powell. And then he went back to America and he said, you know, we need to have this here in the United States.
That's awesome.
I'm totally ignorant of this because I thought for sure the Boy Scouting was an offshoot of the National Park System started by Teddy Roosevelt or something. I had no idea it started in Britain.
This is cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so you made a legend to get back to where you were. I'm sorry for distracting you, Baden Powell, but I wanted to know who he is because I really didn't know. I think it's really neat that you know this stuff. Uh-huh. You're so smart, Bill. Yeah,
it's
so
funny
okay.
the stuff you pick up when you're doing a humongous painting. So I sent this to Frank and to, you know, his council of volunteers, and they went over it and they said, well, this is pretty good. But, you know, this guy isn't really that necessary, but you haven't included this other guy
mm-hmm.
or this other event or moment. So there was a little bit of...
how crappy would it be to be the guy editing. That was almost in the centennial painting?
Yeah.
I mean, he probably will never know, right? As someone who's passed away.
It's probably somebody who's dead by now, yeah.
So you got notes from the council and this Frank fella that was giving you instruction throughout.
Right.
And they came back and you did some editing.
Yeah, so I did some editing in the, you know, and submitted another... diagram
mm-hmm.
design, and once they signed off on it, then I started painting. Well, first I did like a really tight pencil drawing, and then I, you know, put that on canvas and started painting. And it was like most painting projects that I'm involved in, it was just down to the wire.
Now, how long did they give you to complete the painting?
Well.
Because I know he'd been discussing it with you for like 10 years.
Yeah, if you ask Frank, he would probably tell you, you know, I gave him 15 years to do it.
Right, no, he didn't, though.
But, you know, from the time I got, you know, the pencil drawing all approved and everything,
mm-hmm.
I probably had 6 months.
Okay.
Something like that.
And I remember trying to drag you out at some point during there, like, hey, let's all go have some dinner. It's like, no, I have to work on the Boy Scout painting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really consumed a lot of my life for...
Sort of your Sistine Chapel for a while.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's pretty remarkable, though. I mean, what a tremendous gift to be given and horrific responsibility, kind of, you know? But really, like, you're the guy that did that. But the commemorative posters that they passed out, that's not all that happened to your painting. What else did they do with it? Because this is really cool.
Well, they...
They loved it because they...
I don't know how they do this, but I see these on buses.
Yeah, yeah.
Where like they're advertising a movie, and you know they wrap the image even
yes.
over the windows.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And
there's a company here in Los Angeles that does it. But what Bill is trying to tell you guys at home is they put it on the RV.
They put it on
they
the RV.
They loved his painting so much they wrapped the entire RV in his painting.
Yeah, so this this RV's going down the road and it's like my painting, you know, traveling across America.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, it was pretty cool.
It's amazing.
An outdoor gallery.
Yeah. And do you have the original or did you donate it to them?
I donated the original to the National Scout Museum.
Nice.
But you have copies, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Is there an image online where we can put it up so the podcasters can see it?
I can. I don't know if it's still online. I don't know if the website that was that they set up for this thing was acenturyofvalues.org. And I'm not sure if it's, since the event is over, I'm not sure if the website's still there.
Okay.
But I can send you an image.
I would love that. Sure. Yeah, I'd love to post it so everybody can see it.
Sure.
And you know, it's funny because for with you being the guy who did that, you it was sort of in your destiny. For 15 years, they knew you were going to be the one that did this painting. I'm sure that a lot of Boy Scout artist type folk saw that and said, I could have totally done something like that. Now, granted, guys, when you see this image, I've seen it, and it is remarkable. So, no, they couldn't. However, how cool that it was your destiny. I've been places before where, for example, I auditioned to be Elphaba in Wicked Japan, which a lot of people don't know. And I went and auditioned, and it was amazing because the girl in front of me, I kind of, like, you get a vibe when you walk in somewhere, and I thought, I kind of could tell who they were pulling aside and giving numbers to, and I thought, I don't think I'm going to get called back for this. I just wasn't exactly what they were looking for, which was totally fine because auditions aren't personal. You're trying to find somebody to fill that job. However, the girl whose number was before me, I was 20, she was 19, walked in and I heard her, her voice, everything about her. She was exactly what they wanted. And I've cast, so it's very easy for me to be objective in this situation. But it was like the universe was rising to meet her. And her destiny was arriving, like, in that moment. Like, this is what she always wanted to do, and it was about to happen. She was also going to have to learn the whole musical in Japanese, and I did not envy her. However, she was that girl for that show, and you were that guy for this specific painting. And were you honored? Were you just sort of stressed? Like, how does it feel to be that guy?
Well, it was interesting because this thing was a very grassroots event to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from the early planning of it, they didn't even want to tell the National Scout Council about it because they were afraid that they would steal the idea and then get, you know, somebody like, well, not Norman Rockwell because he passed away, but
right.
I'm trying to think of the name of the guy who's like the successor to Rockwell.
Like a Thomas Kincaid?
Yeah, that they would get some like really famous name artist to to do it. And to like to
but they
do
did.
Their
they
version
got
and
you.
Kind of squelch this project.
Sure. You mean like the National Council would want to do it their way and these guys had this idea. And
right.
But it's but great they went with one of their own, you know, a guy who had put those values of the Scouts to work throughout his life and had a career in, you know, has his career in art and then had gone on to, you know, kind of honor where he came from with it.
Right. And Bill, what were you going to say?
Well, as this thing, you know, kind of developed, I became more and more honored because it finally got to the point where it was so far along and it was getting so close to the centennial that they knew the National Council couldn't do anything fast enough to eclipse what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So when that happened and the council took notice of it, they basically just gave it their blessing and they said, this is an official event.
Wow.
So up until that point, it was like, you know,
a couple guys that thought it would be cool.
Yeah, it was almost like a renegade group of scouts who were just decided we need to do this thing because somebody needs to do something and we don't know if the National Scout Council is going to do anything as cool as this. So we're going to do it whether they like it or not. We'll tell them about it eventually, but for now we're going to keep this under wraps.
Nice.
And then, but once they did and the National Council embraced it, then it kind of felt more like, you know, like I was the guy selected of everybody in the United States, although it didn't really start out that way.
But that is what happened.
Yeah.
You were. That, and they couldn't have been luckier. They got the best guy.
Well, getting back to thank you. Yeah. So getting back to what I was saying before about The Simpsons, the whole time I was just marveling at the fact that Frank never saw any of my work in movie posters that I know of. You know, he didn't know that I was a commercial illustrator, you know, that I had a photorealistic painting style. All he knew was that this guy draws The Simpsons, and The Simpsons is huge. And so why wouldn't he be able to paint a realistic, you know, Norman Rockwell style mural of the Boy Scouts?
So how lucky was he?
Yeah, he could have drew them all in a Simpson caricature.
Right, exactly. What if that had happened?
It could have gone very badly.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well, it could have also been kind of cool, but not quite what they were hoping
for. Not the same, yeah.
So now you have, did you want to say anything else about the Scouts? Because I have more questions.
I kind of want to say something about the Scouts.
Okay, go ahead.
I was a Cub Scout for a long time. I mean, for however long you're in there.
He still wears a suit every month.
Yeah. See, I was a Cub Scout, and I really loved it. And I loved a lot of the Cub Scout things, like carving the racer. Like, did you do that? Like,
yeah.
Like
the
soapbox derby
racer. Pinewood Derby.
Pinewood Derby, yeah. Oh, man. My dad and I worked for, you know, nights on end trying to carve it. And I remember screwing it up, and I had to start over again until I got to something that I liked it. And we went to a Cub Scout jamboree and everything. Uh-huh. And I really loved it. And I loved going to the, you know, and putting on the little tie and everything and working my way up from, you know, Cub to Weeblo and everything. And then there was this incident that happened right before when I was a Weeblo. And I just said, I don't want to be the Boy Scouts. And this thing happened. And I just want to put it out there to see if it ever happened to you or some variation of it.
Because
I'm sure they don't do this anymore. We were all Weeblos, and we had like and we met in this neat little lodge and everything that the Boy Scouts had on alternate nights. And the Boy Scouts came over and they said, okay, you guys want to join the Boy Scouts? Let me give you an example of some of the fun and the games that we have. And they had this game, and I had never seen anything like it or experienced anything like it. And I thought, I don't want to join this group. And what it was is that they had us all stand in a circle, mm-hmm. facing inwards. And this was one of the Boy Scout Jamboree games, I guess they did. And what they did was the leader took off a belt and he passed it around in back of them. Is this sounding familiar at all?
No.
Okay, because I want to find out if something funky happened.
I wish
you'd
tell us what happened. Okay.
Well, what happened was the belt went around and they had some either a song or a chant or a count or something. But whoever had the belt would chase the person to his left and smack them with the belt like they were whipping him with it as the other boys cheered. And then the guy who was getting whipped had to go all the way around and take his place again. Then the chant would start again and the belt would be passed around.
Sadistic duck, duck, goose.
Yeah, it was something like that. And of course, I'm the first kid to the, you know, the guy next to me gets it. And I'm, of course, the slowest kid. And I'm running and all the guys are laughing at me. And I'm going like whack, whack on the back of my legs and on my ass. And I get back to my place and I'm going like, I don't want to be in the Boy Scouts if it's like a beating game. And I'm going like,
and then it was really humiliating
this
when
can't
they put
be
him
right.
in a dress and gave him a ball gag.
Yeah. This can't be right, can it? And then I thought, you know, this is probably one of those hazing games that I've heard about, you know, like you go to prep school, you go to college,
but this is not
or the army,
good.
You get hazed or bullied or one of those things. And bullying, you know, it didn't have the onus on it that it has now. I mean, back then, you were bullied as a course of getting through the day. You know, it was just, there were bullies at school. Bullying was everywhere, but it was always kind of accepted. It was like, even in ads at that time, like Applejack cereal, a bowl a day keeps the bullies away. That's mm-hmm. how they sold it. Like, mm-hmm. you could go out, eat your Applejack. You can go out and bully the bullies. But there was something about it that shattered all my illusions. Like, I wanted to go be a Boy Scout and go hiking and go to the woods and
get whipped with a belt,
get a badge in taxidermy or, you know, Indian folklore or something, you know, something really cool. And then it's like, oh God, I gotta get into the system, I gotta get into this club, and it's like a caste system, and now I gotta be whipped and everything like that. And does anything
so
like
this
that
was,
ever happen
well
to you?
Something like that did happen.
Okay.
So But this, your experience,
I mean, I don't
was...
mean to demean the Boy Scouts. I thought it was a lot of fun right up until that point. And I know they do great stuff, and they probably
until
don't do
they
anything.
They beat the shit out of you.
Well, they probably don't do anything like that anymore, but,
oh my
you know.
God.
Well, your experience, now this circle thing, was this run by the adults?
I think so. I mean, I don't know if it was one. I don't remember. I know it was somebody older, and I don't remember. Know if it was like an older boy. Yeah. It was a scout or a scout. I think there was a scout master. And I think there were a couple of Boy Scouts there, and then the Boy Scout master was there to show you the fun that you could expect when you were a Boy Scout.
Yeah. Well, if that was under adult supervision, then that was totally wrong. And,
yeah.
You know, I can't believe, especially in a recruiting situation, that they would have...
Let's show you the horrors of Boy Scouts.
I mean, this would have been...
However, I do have a great idea for my next birthday party.
Oh, good.
Everybody put on this conical hat. Here's a bell.
Misty's Run of Pain. There we go.
Which is just like every other Tuesday.
Okay, this would have been about 1970, I guess. Yeah. You know?
Well, I will tell you there was a an incident in our troop.
Mm-hmm.
It was not sanctioned by any of the adults. The adults had no idea this was happening. But we were on a camporee, which is a...
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jamboree is like a national thing. This is just like a little regional thing with the Detroit Council.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in this metro park, and we were a very new troop. We had, you know, we had mm-hmm. a recruiter who had come to our school and got us all excited about being Boy Scouts. And actually, this is kind of a separate side story, but at the end of this recruiting meeting, you know, we all got to come out of our class and go listen to this guy give his spiel about Boy Scouts and why we should start a troop at our school. The last thing he said was, okay, if you guys are serious about doing this, is there any one of you that has a dad who you think might want to be the scoutmaster? And my hand shot straight up. I said, my dad will do it. And I went home and I told my dad, and you know, you would think most parents would get angry or, you know,
mm-hmm.
get nervous or, you know, just have some kind of negative reaction. And my dad's reaction was, okay, where do I have to go and what time and what
best
do I have to do?
Ever.
Wow.
That's cool.
Yeah. He just totally stepped up. So anyway, this was maybe 2 months later.
Mm-hmm.
So we had started this troop, and basically the guys who started the troop had some kind of superiority complex, and I'm in that group, although I wasn't, you know, necessarily feeling this way. But we went on this camporee, and there were these two new guys who joined just before the camporee, and somehow, like, there was this, we had three patrols, and one patrol was like the older, tougher kids. They were kind of like the bad patrol.
Mm-hmm.
They were called the Ravens.
Of course they were.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided that these two new guys had to get initiated.
Uh-oh.
And, you know, the rest of us, I was in the Panther Patrol, and then we had the Rattlesnakes. And, you know, we decided, okay, you know, what the heck, we'll go along with this. So Saturday afternoon, the Ravens took these two guys, marched them out into the woods. We followed, and we got deep into the woods, and they told these two kids to strip down.
What?
Take their clothes off.
Mm-hmm.
They tied them to a tree and, like, threw stuff at them and ridiculed them.
Oh, no.
I mean, these were bad kids, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
And then they untied them and made them roll down a hill, which turned out had poison ivy.
Oh, God.
Of course.
Yeah. And...
Oh, just cover them with honey and let ants on them. Come on. What's wrong?
Well, yeah. it was nearly that bad. But anyway, we were kind of horrified, but we didn't know what to do, and none of us had the guts to stop it, because these were, like, you know, these kids were tough and intimidating. So I remember we got back to camp, and my dad said, what have you guys been up to? You guys were gone a long time. What's going on? And we said, oh, nothing. We were just out in the woods, hiking around, having fun, doing scout stuff. Well, of course, you know, these kids went home and told their parents, and the parents got irate.
As well they should.
Yeah. And my dad, I thought, handled it great, you know.
What did he do?
They wanted to shut down the troop, these parents. They were really upset. And they also wanted to get at the boys who had done it.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad said, well, you know, I'll take care of this. I will discipline these boys, and I'll make sure that they understand, you know, how wrong this was and that this should never happen again. But I'm not going to preside over a situation where you're allowed to come in and you know, try to discipline them yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So, you know, he totally protected the troop. You know, the troop was allowed to keep going. I think at the time, it might have kind of seemed like he wasn't making the right decision.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause what these kids did was
pretty heinous.
It was pretty heinous. But in retrospect, these guys stayed with scouting. Their lives were totally changed. They all became like upstanding citizens.
These are the Ravens or the kids that were poison ivied? What happened to the kids that got the poison ivy? Did they stay?
They didn't stay.
Okay.
They quit, and I don't blame them. I don't blame them.
But the Ravens are okay. That's horrible. Weird. I don't like that story at all.
Well, did you read about Mitt Romney this last week?
I can't with him and his hair cutting. And you his know hair what?
I don't know. You know, it's
you know
like,
what? No.
Not about him, but it's weird because there is a tradition that goes back of, you know, in the military and the government, and, you know, I went to prep school and everything like that about, you know, hazing. And there's an out and out bullying, and then there's hazing, and then there's initiations and everything. And you wonder, where do you draw the line and what is appropriate and what isn't? And I think that any sort of hazing is not appropriate at all. And
no.
Initiations, even that, you know, like if you're initiated to a club, you pay a fee and they let you in, you know, and then you go out drinking, and that's a good initiation. And a bad initiation is anything where involving physical pain, you know, getting beaten or humiliated or tied up and left in the woods for the aardvarks to eat or whatever, you know, horrible things happen. But I just, yeah, you know, like the Animal House initiation, I don't know. And I guess, and that's the thing that turned me off from scouting. But then again, you know, if these guys, their lives turn around or something.
Well, my dad didn't really have any control over, you know, these two boys, you know, and he couldn't force them to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, he didn't have any influence over their lives after that point.
Mm-hmm.
But the guys who were in that patrol and everybody that was in our troop, I remember at my dad's funeral, guys coming up to me and saying, you know, your dad was like my father.
Aww.
And I didn't have a good father, or I didn't have any father at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have any guidance. And it was, you know, because of that experience where he was my scoutmaster, and, you know, they didn't really come out and say he taught me right from wrong and
all
that.
Did.
But he did.
He gave them a moral compass.
Yeah, I mean, he did discipline them, but, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. but it was done with love, and, you know, it was one of those situations where they realized we're in deep doo-doo, but this guy obviously cares about us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they stuck with it, and they all, I think, as far as I know, became, you know, really
productive,
great guys. Yeah.
I mean, that's a very important thing, is when you've got a positive role model in your life, somebody who sets a moral tone, or just or spiritual, or just, you know, an ethical tone for somebody else to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's happened to me a few times with teachers and, you know, mentors and things like that.
Well, it's funny, you know, like you sometimes feel like you're dealt a sour hand or, you know, a poor hand.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look around, the universe has a way of giving you exactly what you need.
Yeah.
And you go, wow, I didn't really realize that that's what that person was doing there.
Yeah.
You know, or I didn't really realize that that was the example I was being shown and why I made this choice right now, because I saw so-and-so do this kind thing forever ago. You know, it's really fascinating. Mm-hmm. And so your father's circle of influence is huge.
Yeah.
So that's...
And it's nice to be able to pass that along in some way. So there are times like where I, you know, I try and somebody comes up and wants something from me or has, you know, wants to talk. You know, I just try and take the time and listen and pass along some of the attention that I've received from other people who,
sure,
you know, what that I received when I needed it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we were talking a little while ago about you doing the painting for the Boy Scouts. Yes. And I want to get back to art, if that's okay with
you. Sure.
Yeah, because I mean, you're such a Viking, and I kind of want to pick your brain for folks that don't have a chance to sit down with someone like you. And so one of the first things that I want to ask you are personal questions, like, what is your favorite medium in which to work?
Okay. Well, when I'm painting, I mm-hmm. work in acrylics.
Okay.
I have worked in gouache, but I'm not as fond of it.
Why?
And
what is gouache for people?
Gouache is a watercolor.
It's a vegetable that you grow. I'm kidding.
It does sound like that, doesn't it?
It does.
No, gouache is a watercolor that's opaque.
Okay.
So, you know, how most watercolors have a transparent kind of a look, and they go on transparent, and you can layer one over the other and get different effects and different colors. Gouache is more like an oil paint or an acrylic paint, which is primarily opaque. So when you put it down, it completely covers whatever's underneath it. Acrylic paint does have its drawbacks. There are things that you can do with it, things that you can't do with it. It's not really great for blending.
Mm-hmm.
Oil is much better, but I've sort of developed a style which incorporates a little bit of dry brush, which creates kind of a blended effect. But when you get right up close to it, you can see it's a lot more graphic. You can create gradations that aren't like a smooth halftone gradation like you would see in an airbrush.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I've sort of developed a technique that I'm happy with acrylic. I used to paint with an airbrush using acrylic paint when I was working in advertising. And I enjoyed that quite a bit, but the process of airbrushing involves creating friskets.
What's that?
Which is, a frisket is a mask.
Okay.
That you use to expose one area where you want the paint to go.
Okay.
And cover areas where you don't want the paint to go.
Almost like a stencil.
Yeah, it is. It really is a stencil, but it's like a custom stencil.
Do you use tape for that?
Well, what I originally used, which back in art school turned me off completely to airbrushing, it's a method that I was taught by my instructor, was this frisket film.
Mm.
And he was so old school. I mean, you could buy frisket film, which was like a sticky back. You know, you would peel off the wax paper backing, lay it down, and then use an X-Acto knife to cut the area that you wanted to expose, pull that up, and then, you know, spray your paint into that area, and you know, it worked fairly nicely.
Wow.
Although you had to be very careful with the knife, because if you press down too hard, you end up cutting into the board.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up with a painting, because we were not painting on canvas, we were painting on illustration board. You'd end up with a painting that was all hacked to bits because it had all these, you know, little knife marks in it. So you had to have kind of a light touch.
Isn't it amazing, stuff like that and like Zip-A-Tone have fallen by the wayside largely now?
Oh, because yeah, everything's...
you can all do it digitally.
Yeah, everything's digital now. But... I had this instructor who insisted on making us create our own frisket film using tracing paper and rubber cement.
Oh, come on.
Mm. No, I'm not kidding.
I believe that you're not kidding. I just think that's ridiculous.
I know. And we would have to coat the back of the tracing paper, let it dry, and you had to use like just the right consistency of rubber cement, not too thick, not too thin, so that was a pain in the neck. And then nearly invariably, it would, like, you would put down a layer of paint, and we were painting with gouache through the airbrush back then. And then you would get something that you were fairly happy with, put down a new frisket film over top of it, cut another area out, pull it up, and pull up half the paint. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was doing a painting of a vintage car, 1930s mm-hmm. Bugatti.
Nice.
And it was fairly detailed and complicated. And I got about halfway through, and you know, when I started pulling paint up, you know, I mean, things I'd spent hours doing, you know, trying to get these perfect gradations, and then just to see these little specks of it start coming up on the Frisket, God, I just went, hard. This is ridiculous. I'm never gonna paint with one of these ever again.
Uh-huh.
And you know, never say never, because I eventually picked it up again when I discovered that you could spray acrylic through it.
Oh.
And acrylic was a much easier medium.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't come up as easy with the Frisket. And then I learned later that you could, instead of using this sticky film, you could use acetate.
Okay.
And I had a method where I would cut out an area, expose an area to paint through, and then I would cut these little football shape openings all the way around it, and then use tape to on those football shaped areas, I would tape it down and keep it flat that way. Then I joined a studio where they were like, you know, that's ridiculous, don't do that, just use spray mount. Mm-hmm. So we used this kind of light tech spray mount on the back of the Friskets. And because we were painting with acrylic, any sticky residue that was left, you could take rubber cement thinner and clean it away.
Nice.
And nothing would come up. So that was great. Yeah. But my studio mate, Calvin Patton, and I developed this insane Frisket process when we were doing posters for Disney. And we were also doing like big billboard advertisement illustrations. And what we would do is we would take a piece of acetate, lay it on our drawing, and then we would start cutting over the line art of the drawing.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't paint on the drawing. Once we had this system of Friskets, which had all these different flaps, so mm-hmm. we would expose one area that was, say, like Mickey Mouse's pants. So there would be one stencil that exposed his pants.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds dirty.
That's better than what his pants would expose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, right. God knows. And then we would have another flap that we would tape on the left mm-hmm. that would create like a highlight. Another one that we would tape on the left that would create a, like a core shadow.
Mm-hmm.
Any other little shadows. And we would do Frisket on top of Frisket on top of Frisket, until we had like a half inch thick of layers of these different flaps.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would transfer those over to just a clean illustration board. But because we had cut all of these areas, the drawing was there in the cuts.
Wow.
And so we would just put that on our board, and you could see the whole illustration right there on the board, and it was all registered with those little gun sight crosshair stickers.
Oh yeah,
that you can buy. You could buy like a roll of those, and that's how we used to paint. So it was kind of like painting without any drawing underneath. So you had like a perfectly clean board, and I remember people would come into the studio and they would see like this elaborate system of flaps that we were spraying through, and we got so quick that it would be like, and people can't see me doing this, but you'd flip one flap over, spray, flip it over, pull another one down, spray on that, lift it up, see how it looks, and we would just keep doing this back and forth. It's like when you see animators drawing with a mm-hmm. whole sheath of paper, and they're constantly flipping back and forth to see how the animation looks.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing it on different levels, you know,
right.
The character will be on one level, and then any effects like a shadow on him will be on another level.
Yeah. So it was kind of like that. Anyway, it got to be really insane. Mm-hmm. And I decided that I really, even though that was a fun way to work and it produced a unique end product,
mm-hmm.
I really much prefer like putting a brush onto a canvas or onto a board. Just the, you know, because the airbrush, it was removed from, you never made any contact with the board because there's always that couple of inches between the instrument and your hand and what you're doing. And it's kind of like that now with digital artists because, except for like when they're using the Cintiq where they can draw right on the screen, if you're using like a Wacom tablet, you're looking at the screen, but your pen is, or your little stylus is moving, you know, like a foot away from the screen.
Isn't that hard to navigate? I mean, I understand there would be a learning curve, but wouldn't it be extremely difficult to be, I guess it would be no different than learning to use a mouse. It's just a totally different thing than actually holding a pencil, though. Whereas with a Cintiq, where the picture, and for those of you guys that don't know at home, the Wacom tablet is almost like it's almost like an Etch-a-Sketch, but you sort of like, you write on that and what you're doing appears on the computer monitor.
Right.
Whereas the Cintiq actually lights up and it is a monitor.
Right.
You're able to, it's a touch-sensitive monitor.
You're able to put your stylus right on the screen and you can draw in real time and
almost like that Draw Something app, but a little higher level. So, I want to talk to you about that app, but we'll get to the app.
Yeah.
And also Little Mermaid Wiener story.
Of course. We can't forget that. We've been promising. Yeah. But I just like the feeling of, you know, putting the brush on the canvas and having that direct connection to the art. Yeah.
That piece over there, that's airbrushed, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, that's airbrushed. Paul's pointing to a Todd Shore, an original painting by Todd Shore of the Wolf and Red Hot Riding Hood from a Tex Avery video cassette cover, I believe.
That's right. I believe you're right. I thought it had a nice quality, but I just could never even fathom the discipline it would take to have to control an airbrush. Misty, you bought me an airbrush once for Christmas for my models, and I just have never.
It's in the cupboard in there.
Yeah, I've just never gotten around to hooking it up. And
we should give it to Bill. You want it?
What kind is it?
It's a model.
That was rude of me.
No, it's not rude at all.
Well, if it's a badger, then hell no. But if it's an Iwata, yeah.
I don't know. Well, look, it was not cheap, but it wasn't super expensive. We bought it at a hobby shop. Huh. Okay, so I asked you what your favorite medium was. And so my next question actually is going to build on what you and Emily were talking about last week. For those of you at home that don't know or haven't been listening, Emily is also an artist, and she just graduated, and she's a damn good one. And she's just getting started. And so what she was asking you in private, which didn't end up on the podcast, was for apparently really boring to Deuce.
Yeah, Deuce doesn't care at all.
Deuce is just like, I am so tired of this talk. But no, what she was asking you about was portfolio advice.
Yes.
So what I would like to start with is, number one, do you have advice for someone who wants to do what you do when you grow up? Not you specifically, because we've talked about your specific path and how crazy and varied and branched off it was.
Yeah.
My first question to you is, do you have advice for someone who wants to be an artist when they grow up?
Yes. This advice was given to me when I showed my portfolio to a really brilliant airbrush illustrator. I mean, he's a brilliant illustrator no matter what medium he's working in, but he's known mostly for airbrush, man by the name of Charles White III. Mm-hmm. And I came out to California and showed my portfolio to him trying to get a job. And the portfolio was full of images designed to get me work in Hollywood.
Now, just so you guys at home know, a portfolio is a collection of your work
right. That
you would take and show to someone. So it's... You want to tell them the kinds of things that...
Yeah, it can be work that you've produced for clients, or it could be work that you've done just for yourself in order to try to impress somebody and give you a job.
And ideally,
or a mixture of both.
And ideally, you want that portfolio to encompass as many kinds of art as possible. So like, you know, I'm a voiceover girl. So for a voiceover demo, if I were doing an animation demo, I don't necessarily want to wow them with... look at all the different voices I could do, but rather here's some technique and here's some things that I've, not only can I do this, really do this, but you know, here is a range of a professional range that you can now hire me to do, which is essentially what a portfolio is. Right?
I think in general, although it depends on who you're showing the portfolio to.
Sure.
Because sometimes you're going in for something very specific, and you know they don't give a damn if
about
you can
your
do pen
painting
and ink
of a
or,
monkey. Yeah,
yeah, they want to look at one thing and they want to see 10 good examples of that.
Like, for example, do you want to? I don't really feel like I'm covering this well, but anyway, if for example, if you were going in to The Simpsons, you would want, if someone were bringing you a portfolio at Bongo,
yes,
you would probably want to see 10 different examples of them being able to draw on model, because that's what you need them to do, or their
right.
colorist work.
Yeah, I mean, we wouldn't want to see just The Simpsons,
right.
just how they do The Simpsons. But we, it's funny, you know, we get a lot of submissions from artists who are drawing, like, you know, these big gnarly superhero drawings of these guys with, you know, muscle upon muscle, or, you know, babes with big phony breasts and, you know, bursting out of their costumes. And our reaction is always, do you know what we do at Bongo? Because, mm-hmm. you know, this might get you a job at Image or even DC, but this is nothing like what we do.
Mm-hmm.
So what we look for is not necessarily exactly what we do, but something that's in the ballpark.
Okay.
So, you know,
to show that they could function well within your realm.
Yeah, to show that you can do humor, or mm-hmm. that you can follow model sheets and do a licensed character. Like if somebody came in with, you know, something they did for Scooby-Doo.
Or Garfield.
Or Garfield, yeah, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like these are established characters that have a certain look. And I can see from this sample that you know how to follow a model sheet because you've aped it
mm-hmm.
and you've done it well.
If I can cut in for a second, this is a question that I get asked a lot as far as writing goes, is people say to me all the time, I'm trying to get on a certain show, like a sitcom, like I want to get on Modern Family.
Sure.
So I have a Modern Family spec. How can I show that to the producers? And I'll say, well, you don't really want to show them a spec from their own show, because no one knows those characters better than they do.
Mm-hmm.
And no one understands the nuances and the rhythm of those character voices. So you might, even though it might be very well written and might be funny, it's you're showing it to the experts. So you would gain a lot more if you show them like a sample episode of, say, something like The Middle or Parenthood or...
A show in a similar vein,
like another sitcom.
Well, like what Bill just mm-hmm. said.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
If you're trying out, essentially auditioning, which is when someone submits a portfolio, they're auditioning for you
mm-hmm.
to
yeah.
work on The Simpsons book. You're going to want to see not necessarily The Simpsons, but something, like you said, that would show that they can draw on model and draw humor and draw within the style and the realm in which you function.
Yeah, right. It's very similar.
As long
yeah.
as it's not Family Guy.
Oh, you don't like Family Guy?
No, we just... We reject those just out of hand.
Why? I know you're kidding. But I know you're kidding, but is it just a joke around the office? Or is it, oh, he's not kidding. Okay.
No, I am kidding. If somebody came in with, you know, Family Guy drawings and they look like Family Guy, then I would say the same thing as for Garfield or, you know, Powerpuff
mm-hmm.
Girls or whatever. It's
mm-hmm.
like, okay, obviously you know how to follow a model sheet.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
but that's not all we look for.
Well, okay, well, and we'll get there in just a second.
Okay.
Okay, but you were going to tell them some advice. The very first thing, and yes, Ezra, I know how long this is. It's just going to be a long one. Okay. If the first thing is, when someone is putting together a portfolio, and we sort of covered this, just, you know, just very quickly,
yeah.
The first thing that they should do is consider whom they're sending it to
right.
and what you would be looking for and in what realm they would be, you know, functioning to show you that they have a level of quality work in that realm specifically. And
right.
if they have other things that would show range beyond what you would need, lovely. But focus on essentially who you're marketing to,
yeah.
right? That would be the first step in putting together a portfolio.
Yeah.
And then you were going to tell a story about portfolio advice, but do you have any other advice in assembling a portfolio first before we move on?
You mean the physical
yep.
assembling of it?
Yeah. If somebody at home were putting together a portfolio, just in general, what kinds of things as an artist do you feel are important?
Well, this was the advice that I was
great.
Given.
So this leads right into it. Okay.
Yeah. This is what Charlie White told me. And the portfolio that I took to Hollywood, I really wanted to work in a studio like his.
Okay.
And they did movie advertising. They did record album covers. They did greeting cards. They did like really fun what you would call California airbrush images back then. And that was what I was passionate about and what I was looking for. So I filled this portfolio with images that I did, like I did a phony movie poster, you know, for a popular movie, but I did like my take on it. I did like record album cover images. I did a couple of movie star portraits. And so I took it in and, you know.
So just to say, you brought in things that you had designed, you'd done the graphic art design on, yes, as well as realistic photo painting and stuff like that. So you're really showing him a very wide range.
Yeah, it was all illustration, but it was a range. You know, it wasn't everything I do.
Sure.
I didn't show him like pen and ink stuff,
uh-huh,
like comic book style, because at the time that's not what I was trying to get into.
Mm-hmm.
And I also knew that wasn't what his studio did. So it was all stuff that was sort of geared towards knocking Charlie White's socks off.
Okay.
And so I'm nervously sitting there while he's flipping through my book, and he's being very polite and, you know, not flipping through too fast,
mm-hmm,
but not really lingering on anything, until he came to this one image, and it was a painting of Lauren Bacall,
mm-hmm,
the famous 1940s movie star. And he stopped on that, and then he didn't say anything. He just kind of studied it. And, you know, I'm sitting there just kind of going nuts because I don't know what he's thinking. You know, is he going to start telling me everything that's wrong with it? Or has he stopped on it because he likes it? So finally he said, you really enjoyed doing this image of Lauren Bacall, didn't you? And I said, well, yeah, I guess so. Like, you know, 20-somethings do. He said, yeah, I guess so. And he said, no, seriously, think about it. Like, when you were painting this, there was emotion involved. Like, you're emotionally attached to this painting. And I said, well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, of all the stuff in the book, it's my favorite. And I mean, I had to kind of think about it. Wasn't really that in touch with the emotional aspect of it. But the more I thought about it, I thought, yeah, he's right. And I actually painted it for my sister.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, I could tell because it's the best piece in the book.
Oh.
And he said, the reason it's the best is because it's the only one you really cared about. He said, everything else in here, you did it just to try to get a job. He said, but this you did because you love it and it shows.
Wow.
So he said, I'm not saying don't do stuff in your portfolio designed to get you work. You know, I'm not saying don't do a movie poster image, you know, even if you, he says, there's always going to be stuff that you're going to have to do and you're not going to get passionate about. But if you're trying to impress somebody and show your best work, you need to put in more images of things that you just love to do,
mm-hmm,
because that's when you're going to shine. That's when you're really going to do your best work. And I never forgot that. And that's when people ask me what advice do I have for someone putting a portfolio together, that's always my answer. Just do what you're passionate about and your best work is gonna come out.
Let me ask you something that's sort of akin to this is, getting away a little bit from personal passion, and how diverse do you think a new artist's portfolio has to be? Like somebody just entering the marketplace, and if you have liked, let's say, classic Looney Tunes all your life, and your portfolio is largely made up of that,
mm-hmm,
should you, I think it goes without saying that you need to mix it up a little bit. Like, despite the fact that you may love that great style of design, should you put some painting in it, some lettering, some other things, some computer work?
And I think that's what Charlie was saying too, is he was saying, don't, he says, you're always going to have to show things that are marketable, that show, you know, that you can solve a problem,
mm-hmm,
and that you can give a client what they're looking for. But that's just going to show the art director, or whoever's looking at your portfolio, that's going to show them your versatility, and that's going to show them that, you know, you can take an assignment and run with it. But the thing that's really going to impress them and make them want to hire you is the stuff that you really love. So if, you know, your big thing is Looney Tunes, but nobody's buying Looney Tunes, then, you know, put a couple of pieces in there to really show yourself off. But then, you know, do some other stuff that you know is going to be more along the lines of what's selling right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, that is...
Even if that's not something you're passionate about.
Well, that is something that I've gotten quite a lot in the past when I've done portfolio reviews. I would do them occasionally for Warner Animation and at animation festivals, where somebody would come along and they'd say, all I want to draw is the classic Daffy Duck, like Chuck Jones would draw it. And in their portfolio, there'd be... That would just be it. Mm-hmm. And you kind of want to tell them that, you know, and I'm sure there are artists like that who just want to draw the classic Steve Ditko style or Frank Miller style, and that's all that's in their portfolio. There has to be a little bit more diversity just to show that they can kind of stay one step ahead of an ever-changing marketplace, you know, because to just draw the style of an artist you really, whose work you love, is really not doing much of a credit to yourself, I would say, right?
Yeah, and I think I'm fortunate because I have varied interests, and I'm passionate about a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. I think the reason that piece, that Lauren Bacall painting, was as good as it was, you know, as I mentioned, I had done it for my sister, so I was really trying to impress her.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And do something beautiful for her, but also I love the subject matter, and it wasn't so much about the style of the painting, mm-hmm. as it was about the fact that, you know, I just thought Lauren Bacall was so beautiful, and I wanted to capture that and give it to my sister. But I think when people get too myopic and locked into one thing, and they only want to do that, mm-hmm. That hardly ever works out. You know, that I think it's very rare that somebody can fill a portfolio just with one thing, especially if it's something that's not really hot at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, which isn't to say that they won't evolve into a distinct style of their own. Like I remember looking at a lot of Tim Burton's early sketches that go back to when he was a student, and you could see that he had an original style, but you could also see there were echoes of Edward Gorey and Tommy Unger and even some like mid-50s Ward Kimball type designs, mm-hmm. in his work, and that was all, I guess, what was going through his head and influencing him. But if you look at how he combined those all in, to his current work, you'd say, oh, that's the Tim Burton work. Yeah. And so I guess a lot of it is just sort of like a marriage of a lot of influences and styles that can sort of evolve into, you know, a personal style.
Bill, you have a very specific style. You are able to function within an enormous range. I mean, you can do everything from Simpsons line art to photorealism. And I mean, some of the pieces, and I really want to plug your art show before we're done here,
oh,
too, because it's, I mean, and I want to do it every week. So, because he's got a big art show coming up in Michigan. It's a pretty big deal. So do you want to, I want to talk about your style. I want to talk about your art show. And I want to talk about what you perceive as in the current market. And I know there are all different kinds of, you know, art jobs available out there, but specifically in comics and the way that digital media and stuff is going, what an artist's job currently is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's too broad a question, but those three things. So your style, your art, and what artists can and are doing, what the current opportunities are for artists right now. So do you want to tackle one of those first? Let's talk about your style first. How did you come? We talked about your favorite medium. What's your favorite art style? Like, if there was a Bill Morrison, I just made gross finger quotes, but if there was like a Bill Morrison style, I did it again, style of painting, what would it be?
I really don't know.
Okay.
To be
That's fair.
To be honest, I don't know. And people tell me I have a distinct style.
Mm-hmm.
and I don't see it.
Okay.
I do.
Everybody says I do. And people can even look at my Simpsons work and tell that I did it.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, you know, Phil Ortiz or another Simpsons artist. I don't know. It's like I'm influenced by so many different artists. And I think at some point in your career or in your journey as an artist, you stop copying other people and you just let your experience of loving their work influence what you do, but you're not really trying to ape one artist or another.
Mm-hmm.
So I think everybody at some point gloms on to an artist who's their favorite, and then they just try to be as good as that person.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when I was doing the Rocketeer story that Paul wrote. You know, in my mind, I wanted it to look like Dave Stevens drew it. But as I started drawing it, you know, I just sort of relaxed, and eventually it just looked like I drew it.
Yeah.
And that's okay, you know. I mean, there's that Dave Stevens fan inside me that's going, oh, it's not as good as Dave. But, you know, after it's all done, you know, you step back and look at it and go, well, that's how I would handle the Rocketeer, and that's how I did handle it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know,
I do that with everything.
If I can make a statement, like you and I collaborated on a few Jingle Bell stories, and mm-hmm. my favorite is the one about her with the rivalry of another girl. Oh, I'm going to tear up because it's an emotional story. Here I am. Crying again. I was crying all over the Kevin Smith podcast too. But I think that you have this great strength toward capture. But that's the thing, is you have the strength of capturing the emotion in a story and through the characters in a really warm and wonderful way, which mm-hmm. is why I like that story so much. And it's a story that came out about 10 years ago where Jingle was cruel to a girl years before who was a Santa's helper in a department store. And that, as a result, that woman, you know, a girl who loved Christmas grew up hating it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so she kind of travels back through time to set things straight. But there's such a each of the emotions, you know, like the uncertainty, the humor, the irritation that Santa has with Jing, with the cruelness in the older woman, it came out beautifully. And I really think that you're a terrific actor with a pencil when it comes to rendering the emotion of something. At least that's the way I always thought about that story, and I really loved it.
Well, thank you. I still think I struggle with getting emotion. So, I mean, because I think it's hugely important when you're working in comics. You know, everybody says comics are film on paper, which is, you know, fairly true. But you're crippled because you don't have sound, you don't have movement, sometimes you don't even have color.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these things are things that that portray emotion mm-hmm. in a movie or in a TV
they
show.
They intensify
and film.
The flavor, yeah.
Yeah, and, uh-huh. and when you don't have that, all you really have is your ability to act with a pencil.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, some of that is in the way you stage a shot. Some of that's in the lighting. Some of that's just in the way, you know, the story moves across a page. But a lot of it is in the facial features, you know, the expression of the eyes or the mouth. And that's still something that I feel I struggle with. And, you know, sometimes if an emotion isn't coming, if like I'm reading something Paul wrote in a script, and I want to communicate that on the page, and I don't feel like it's coming across the way Paul intended it, you know, I might get a mirror out and look at myself, you know, try to get myself to express that emotion and then try to replicate that on the page.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy, and it's something that I just feel I'm always working at. So I appreciate that. You know, that you think I nailed it, but
oh yeah,
I rarely think that I do.
I respectfully disagree. There were so many nice moments in that story. That two of my favorites are one where Jing is getting a lecture from Santa about something, and she just drifts away like she's not even listening, and she's going, I wonder if there's anything good on TV right now. And then in the flashback to the 40s, she's getting kind of the same lecture, and she's just going, drifted away, I wonder if there's anything good on the radio right now. And it was terrific. I also loved her costume that you put her in, which was very 40s. It was like the Swiss Miss, you know, version, that something that she would have worn at that time.
It was like an early version of her costume.
Yeah. But it's like, yeah, I just love the thought process. And when I can see, I have a general idea what the story is and I've written it down. And then when I see it take shape on the page, you know, it just like this, I'm really enjoying this, you know, and that's because of the emotion that you put into it.
Okay. I'm going to ask you next week, because we are going so long on this thing, about opportunities for artists, how to sort of like get your foot in the door and all that kind of stuff. So we'll start with that next week.
Okay.
And I swear, guys, we will get to this Little Mermaid story. I'm so sorry. It's just so interesting. And it's like it's so funny because it's about a weenie. It's like the big weenie tease. It's like hysterical. And there are also a couple of other things that I really want to get to, like Dan DiCarlo. So much ground to cover with you. But before we go, I really, really, really want you to talk about your art show. And we're going to do this for the next couple of weeks we have you on. Where is it? When is it? How can they get there? Is your stuff available online? All that stuff. It's so cool.
So, well, thank you. I really appreciate the plug. But it's a show called Detroit Pop.
Uh-huh. All
right.
And as you've heard us say, Misty and I are both from the Motor City. And it seems like when you're from Detroit, I've lived in California for a couple of decades, and I still call Detroit home.
I do too.
I still say I'm going home when I go there.
Yeah. I do too.
And there's a certain amount of, because Detroit is so kicked around and underprivileged in a lot of ways. Detroit's a real underdog city.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because of that, you get that extra feeling of pride when there's something that really great that comes out of your town.
Mm-hmm. It's exciting to champion.
It is.
Yeah.
And so I was, about 8 years ago or so, I was listening to an Alice Cooper song. Mm-hmm. And Alice Cooper got his start in Detroit. He was born in Detroit. Family moved to Arizona, but then as a teenager, he left home. And when he started his band, he decided, we're going to get started in Detroit. So mm-hmm. he went back to Detroit, and that's where the Alice Cooper band started.
Mm. And you ended up working with him on The Simpsons later on.
I did.
Treehouse of Horror.
Oh, yeah.
What an experience that was. But anyway, I was listening to this Alice Cooper song, a recent one called Detroit City, where mm-hmm. he talks about he mentions a lot of the really great musical acts and performers that have come out of Detroit. And I've always been aware of those people, but to hear them all mentioned in one song, it makes you just go, wow. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he's talking about Kid Rock, Eminem, Bob Seger, Ted Nugent, Iggy Pop, you know, not to mention Motown and Aretha mm-hmm. Franklin and, you know, so many great artists, Susie Quattro. And I just thought, you know, I want to do something separate from my comic book work that is a monument to these great artists that have come out of the city that I love. So I had an offer from the River's Edge Gallery in Wyandotte, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit, to do another show, and I wanted to
another show because you just did one. What was it? Four years ago?
It's probably like 7 years ago now.
Yeah.
Back when we were first dating, you went to it.
Yeah, we were dating at the time. Yeah, we weren't married yet, because I was still living there.
Yeah.
And I got in a fight with somebody over a
friggin'
walrus painting that I still haven't seen, and he doesn't even know where it is. Oh, John. Anyway.
Well, that show was like a retrospective, so it was 20 years worth of illustration and comic book art.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really have anything beyond that to show, so I knew if I was going to do another show at the River's Edge, it had to be original. So I had the idea to do this Detroit Pop show. I thought it was perfect for, you know, as a show to premiere in the Detroit area. And somewhere along the line, I got the idea to juxtapose the images of these performers with advertising graphics from soda pop. Now, here in California, we call that fizzy stuff that's multi-flavored that you drink with hamburgers and fries, we call that soda out here. But in Detroit, we call it pop.
Mm-hmm.
It's just known as pop.
Mm-hmm.
So...
do you want to tell them why?
Because of the bottle, actually.
Because of the way the bottle was constructed. We had marble sodas here. Remember we were having marble sodas?
Yeah.
And you were the one that told me why. And I said, oh, how about that?
The original bottles that soda was marketed in and distributed in had a little marble that would seal off the top of the bottle. And there was a little device at the top that allowed you to release the marble. And it went into a, like a little side pocket in the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And then it, you could make it come back out and seal off the bottle again. But when you unlodge that marble, it made a popping sound. And so they used to call it soda pop.
Mm.
And so that was the origin of the word soda pop. And in Detroit, we just shortened it to pop.
Where here they shortened it to soda, right. We shortened it to pop.
Right.
I just assumed it was a carbonation.
Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. I thought that when you, you know, kids were always shaking up bottles, and when you put up, when you pulled out the pop top, it went pop, and now came the bubbles. Yeah.
Well, I
didn't know they did the marble thing all those years ago.
It's not just marble soda from Japan.
Whoa.
It actually is the way it used to be before they changed the methods of sealing off those bottles with the twist tops.
Before they came up with
the metal,
the crimped metal cap.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In Boston, we call it tonic.
Oh.
Called what tonic?
Soda.
The stuff you drank your gin with?
Well, that was a weird thing. You know, you
got your horrors as a baby.
Do you want a tonic? And it's like, no, I don't want, you know, as a kid, I lived in a lot of places when I was a kid. So it's like, when I moved back to Boston, you want a tonic? It's like, no, I don't want quinine water. It's like, no. Like a strawberry tonic or a phosphate or something like that.
Well, in the South, they call it Coke.
Everything's Coke.
I remember working, I think I've mentioned this on here before, but my grandparents were in the Masons in Eastern Star. My grandmother's still active. My grandfather since passed away. And they had these fundraisers every summer at the Wise County Old Settlers Reunion, this tri-county area between Dallas and Fort Worth where my grandparents are from. And they would operate, the Masons in Eastern Star would operate as a fundraiser, this huge soda trailer. Mm-hmm. And it was the only, they had the corner on soda. They were it for the whole fair. So they did quite well. However, everybody would come up and order a Coke.
Uh-huh.
And I would bring them a Coke, and they'd say, no, I wanted a 7-Up, or, you know, a Sprite, or, you know, whatever. And I thought, you ordered a Coke? And they said, no, you have to ask them what kind of Coke they want.
Yeah.
And I said, that's just ignorant. And my grandmother said, that is business. Ask them what kind of Coke they want. But they were just delighted when I called it pop. They thought it was the funniest
thing.
That was
quaint.
They thought I was ignorant and quaint. Yes, quaint, exactly. That's very nice.
See, in the East Bay, it was soda pop. You know, like
see, that's okay.
You know, like do you want a soda pop? And it's like, yeah, I'll have an orange, you know, or a Coca Cola or something like that.
Well, but that's less specific than a Coke. I mean, Coke is the brand name for a specific kind of cola.
Yeah.
You know, and you order a Coke, and then you have to say what kind.
Right.
And
also,
they say, well, a Dr. Pepper.
Now, you know, you've got Cherry Coke, you've got Lime
New
Coke.
Mm-hmm. New Coke.
Which, New Coke.
New Coke.
What?
We just
got
that, right? Yeah.
Thank you, 80s robot.
What?
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay.
But,
so we're off your show.
It's even more confusing.
Yeah, because there's lots of kinds of Coke. Can we not talk about this and get back to your show, please? Because
we're
so long.
Okay, I'm so sorry.
No, don't apologize. It's me. I mean, I'm on about the... I'll tell them about the soda pop. This is totally my fault.
Every Tuesday at the Spider-Man meeting, you know what we have? Faygo Pop.
Where did they get it from?
I don't know, but somebody in the Marvel offices Film Roman stocks up with Faygo.
What kind of Faygo?
Root beer.
Oh.
Faygo
root
beer.
No, it's
not
Rock
and Rye. I know.
Rock and Rye is the stuff.
You can get Faygo now at that Rocket Fizz.
Yes.
Yeah.
We do, because we've had it for, you know, we have Halloween parties and stuff like that.
Yeah. That's hard to get hold of.
Knee-high is here.
No, they don't import it here right here.
It's not the same. My mom hates it, because whenever I go home, the first thing I do is stop at Mr. C's Deli and grab some Faygo peach soda. And she cannot stand the smell of it. To the point where I actually bought a peach air freshener and hung it in her car, because she just, it makes her, she gets a gag reflex.
I don't think I've ever had the peach.
Oh, it's so good. Well, do you like artificial peach flavoring?
I do.
Then I highly recommend it. All it's right. so delish. Try that. You know, but rock and rye and cream soda.
Red
and
pop.
And it says pop right on the bottle because they know how to do it right.
Right.
You know, so there's that. And there's another one. There's red pop. And I mean, there's so many different flavors, but there's another famous one. It's rock and rye. And what's the other one?
Red pop.
That well, maybe it is red pop that I'm thinking of. But I feel like Faygo, there's another.
Faygo used to have several different kind of knockoff flavors.
Uh-huh.
So one of them was moonshine,
which was like Mountain Dew.
Was like Mountain Dew, and that was a lemon lime, but no, it was more like a moonshine.
Mm-hmm.
They had one called or more like Mountain Dew. They had one called Uptown, which was like 7-Up.
Oh.
It was a lemon lime.
Mm.
Which they just called lemon lime now.
Yeah.
Mm. Do they have a pineapple soda?
Yes.
Okay.
They must.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
I think anyway, at least I think they do. It's okay, so your show.
So,
here we go.
Somewhere along the line,
so buy Faygo.
Yeah.
And Better Made Chips. And Better, Kowalski.
And Velvet Peanut Butter.
Velvet Peanut Butter and Kowalski Sausages, which that's I've been begging him to put in his art, and it's not in there yet. So he's been juxtaposing these musicians with advertising images, and that was where we left off.
What about Sanders Chocolate? Is that in there?
Yeah.
Not yet. So, so the images of these rock stars and pop stars are juxtaposed with advertising images of primarily Detroit-based pop, or what we would call soda,
mm-hmm.
With some variations. I've got like some of the advertising mascots from Velvet Peanut Butter,
nice.
And
Milky the Clown.
Milky the Clown.
Oh.
The Twin Pines Magic Clown. anyway, it's all, you know, regional Detroit-based stuff. It's I think for anybody who's not from Detroit, They'll probably look at these images and just think it's kind of weird, cool,
pop art.
Yeah. But for people who are from Detroit, it'll have an extra added meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So the show is, it opens June 15th at the River's Edge Gallery, and there's an artist reception. There's an artist reception on the 23rd of June. I'll be flying into town for that.
Mm, nice.
And it'll be up until, I think, the middle of July.
Is there a website people can visit to find out more information?
There is a website. It's artattheedge.com. That's the River's Edge's website. And then I have a Facebook page, which is whatever the preliminary Facebook.
/ Bill Morrison.
I think it's just Facebook/Detroit Pop.
Oh, Detroit Pop. Okay.
Yeah.
So great. Get your butts over there and like Detroit Pop.
Yes, yeah. Please like it.
Do it.
Like it a lot.
Somehow, Sanders Fudge is what we were talking about, and Morley Candy. Remember selling Morley Candy when you were little? So all these Detroit things. Okay, so this is a really long one, guys. Thank you for sitting through it with us. Hopefully next week we'll get to The Little Mermaid. I have so many other questions for Bill. So, Bill, thanks for this. And we're looking forward to having you back next week.
Thank you all for sticking around. And I'm sure somebody really interesting will be coming on after my month-long stint.
You are the interesting, sir. You're pretty fabulous. Yeah. So next time we'll talk a little bit more about opportunities for artists and Dan DiCarlo and the Eisner Awards and your drum lessons and Jane Wiedlin and The Little Mermaid and all this stuff for next week, guys.
Wow. We have a lot to talk about. Let's get to it.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or at Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.